Welcome to another episode of Let Go and Lead, where we discuss the new realities of leadership with pioneers, provocateurs, and passionate leadership champions. My guest today is Sally Jenkins, an award-winning sports columnist and popular feature writer for The Washington Post. She's a Pulitzer Prize finalist and the first woman to be inducted into the National Sports Writers and Sportscasters Hall of Fame. Sally's also the author of multiple books, including her latest entitled The Right Call: What Sports Teach Us About Work and Life. I can't wait to dig into this conversation with Sally to explore the leadership lessons we can take from high-performing coaches and athletes in the world of sports. So get comfortable and get ready to let go and lead. Hi, Sally. It's so great to see you again. Thanks so much for joining me on Let Go and Lead.
My pleasure.
I'd like to dive right in and talk about your latest book, which is titled The Right Call: What Sports Teaches Us About Work and Life. As you conducted research for the book, you talked with some of the world's most elite coaches and athletes about factors that drive their success. And one intriguing thing that you found is that they all have seven things in common. Can you talk to us more about that?
Sure. What I did was I went through all the people I've known and talked to, you know, whether it was Tony Dungy or Steve Kerr or Steph Curry. And I went through all my notes and I asked myself, what are the principles that they all have in common? Where do all roads intersect? And I identified those areas, you know, conditioning, practice, discipline, candor, resilience in the face of failure. You know, each one became a chapter. And I suppose I could have fancied their names up. I mean, you know, there's a million psychobabble terms for practice or conditioning, but I actually really wanted to take the fact that these are very abstract principles and modes of behavior in sports and leadership, but we very rarely define exactly what they are. You know, we throw those words around vaguely all the time, but we don't really break down what we mean by them. You know, what is practice? What is good practice and deliberate practice that enables you to make measurable improvements, not just on the things that you're good at, but on your biggest weaknesses, which is the real key of good practice. You're practicing to remedy weaknesses, right? Not just hitting forehands and running around your lousy backhand your whole life. Practice is purposeful activity with measurable improvements under the analytical eye of a good diagnostician. That's what the elites like Peyton Manning and Tom Brady do. They don't just go out and wing footballs around, you know? So that's the kind of thing I wanted to get at. I wanted to take these vague, abstract terms that we very rarely investigate the real meaning of, and then break them down for the reader and say, this is what it looks like when the greats go about their business.
So, as you said, so the chapters are conditioning, practice, discipline, candor, culture, resilience, and intention.
Yeah.
Of those, could you pick one that you think has really the greatest impact for truly great athletes?
Probably the chapter on failure, because I don't know an athlete and especially a great athlete who hasn't struggled with failure deep in their soul. You know, everyone loses. There's no going undefeated in any endeavor. And the thing that separates the great ones from the rest is their resilience in the face of that. They analyze their failures. They process their failures. They go to work in very specific ways to cope with a failure. They do great after-action analysis and reports. And the great ones, this is really striking, they do not whine about the officiating. They really don't. If you hear, one thing I've learned throughout my career is that if you hear a coach or a team bitching about the officials, you can be pretty sure they're going to lose again the next year too. They're really very dispassionate about their performances and, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, my favorite statistic every year at the Super Bowl is I like to go down the rosters and look at how many players on each Super Bowl team were not even drafted coming out of college. You know, and usually it's a good, you know, 40-50% of the roster. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the year they won the Super Bowl with Tom Brady, they had 27 players on the roster who'd only been rated 2 stars or less in high school out of the 5-star.
Wow.
Yeah, out of the 5-star rating system.
Yeah.
So 27 members of a Super Bowl team were considered in high school not good enough to be recruited by a college. So that tells you a lot about the resilience of NFL players in reaching, you know, a championship level. They've been told, most of them have been told at one stage or another that they really weren't good enough. The rest of us are easily destroyed by that statement or by that external opinion, you know, and they aren't. It makes them mad and they go back to work. You know, they're out there to prove something to themselves about who they are. They're self-defining out there. You know, I'm the guy or I'm the woman who can do this. I'm the kind of person who's not going to let external opinion define who I am. I'm going to find out who I am for myself. And that's what's really going on out there. I mean, it's pretty profound when you think about it. You know, they want to show that they're the ones who can take it and get back up again. They're the ones who will work on a Wednesday morning at 6 a.m. when nobody's watching. You know, they do a lot of that. And that is what defines their self-worth, what they're doing on a Wednesday morning, not what they're doing on a Sunday, you know, in a stadium.
And from your research, do you have the sense that that also applies to people in the corporate world?
I do. I mean, I think the people who really succeed at anything are more, and this is a big theme of the book, and it's something I learned from people like Pat mm-hmm. Summitt and like Steve Kerr. You know, it's strange to say and counterintuitive, but they're really not in it for the championships. They can't be because you don't win enough of them. Pat Summitt coached for 38 years and she won a record 8 championships. But that means that 30 years out of her life, she went home a bitterly disappointed loser. And if she was only in it for the winning and the trophies, she could not have lived that way. She was in it for the exercise. She was in it for the love of coaching, you know, in its own right, for its own sake. She was a teacher at heart, not a winner. Steve Kerr is very much the same way. Steve Kerr won championships as a player. As a coach, he has won championships as well. But that's not really the business that he's in. He's in the business of teaching, you know, and working with players to help unlock, you know, all the doors in their potential.
And of the 7 principles, do you think there's one that's the most difficult to master?
Well, discipline is the trickiest one to discuss because so many people misinterpret what it means, whether it's in a locker room setting or a corporate setting or an office setting. There's just a lot of bad leaders in the world. You think that discipline is ordering people around, demanding that they work over long hours or, you know, things like that. And actually, discipline is an interior construct that you can foster as a leader. You can't impose it externally. You have to identify the people who want to have it. You have to identify the people who want to buy into whatever the values are inside your organization, and then let those people be your disciplinary leaders. The only people who take well to being ordered around these, you know, in adult life live in barracks, right? I mean, they're in the military. The rest of us don't want to live that way. So you have to call up people's internal discipline, you know, and let your organization construct its own. You can foster it, but not impose it. And that was a really interesting subject in the book to talk to coaches about. I mean, Steve Kerr and Doc Rivers, you know, are these, you know, very powerful personalities who played in the NBA, but they acknowledge they can't tell their young players, hey, man, put your cell phone down in the locker room. It won't work. They have to ask those players, what do you guys want to do together? Not impose it on them externally. It won't work.
And how do you think these learnings can inspire all of us in terms of how we lead our own teams?
I think we can just become a lot more alert to our own habits and environments. And also to we can categorize the quality of decisions that we're trying to make. We could just be clearer in general. Athletes do not drift. What they do is highly self-determined, highly organized. Most of us could be a lot more organized in how we go about our work and how we think about our decisions. And instead, sometimes we just default through the day. We get overwhelmed by the number of things we have to do without prioritizing them as well as we could. So one thing I've learned is athletes are great creatures of regimen and routine. They're very, very highly organized. You know, a first down decision on the football field has different consequences and stakes from a fourth down decision. The same is true in our lives. There are some decisions we don't have to make there because, and we're making too many decisions that are meaningless and very, very low stakes and yet we're trying to decide everything, as opposed to understanding what are the four really critical decisions I have to make first down through fourth down, you know, and categorize those along with the consequences. Is a decision reversible or irreversible? Is it a question of, you know, if I make this decision, there's no getting out of it afterwards, as opposed to a decision that can be an experiment. You can try it. If it doesn't work, the consequences aren't that bad. You know, a lot of us don't know why we say yes to things. I'm one of them. You know, why do I agree to do certain things? Is it to please other people? Is it because I got momentarily tempted by the money and I bitterly regret it afterwards because I really overbooked myself? You know, those are the sorts of things that athletes are very clear. They have a clarity that I envy and have tried to emulate.
That's really interesting. You know, and I, of course, there's that whole thing of saying yes to too much, right? Because every time you say yes to something, you're really saying no to something else. But we often don't think of it that way.
Yeah. And we, I think most of us are pleasers, you know, probably. We want to please bosses. We want to please families. We have multiple obligations. And it's very difficult to say no. I have a friend who told me once, look, if you can't say no, at least buy yourself some time by saying, I'll have to get back to you on that. You know, if you're too weak to say no in the moment, buy yourself time until you can muster the will to actually say, I'm sorry, I cannot do that. I simply don't have time.
That's great advice. So let's go back to 2005, when you were the first woman to be inducted into the National Sports Writers and Sportscasters Hall of Fame. What did that feel like to break that glass ceiling?
You know, I don't know. It's funny. I felt like there were a couple people who should have come ahead of me, to be frank. Leslie Visser was just inducted, and I felt like Leslie, who was a great sports writer for the Boston Globe, the first woman to cover the New England Patriots, people like that. There were some pioneers who came before me that I felt should have been maybe a little bit more ahead of me in line. I was glad to see Leslie inducted. I've had some great friends in the business. So I'm a little abashed by that, to tell you the truth. But I love being there. I mean, it's a great honor to be alongside my dad, to be considered somebody who has lived up to the privilege and the promise of being Dan Jenkins' daughter is what means as much to me as anything. You know, the fact that I've done everything with the opportunity that I was given. I've been a hard worker. I've been devoted to the craft, which is what he just wanted me to learn my craft. And, I think that if the induction means a lot to me, it would be for that reason, that I think that it means that, you know, I pleased my dad.
That makes me want to cry. That's great. I'm glad you mentioned your dad. I'd love to talk about him. Dan Jenkins was a Hall of Fame sports writer, a longtime writer for Sports Illustrated, and the author of several books. How did his career influence yours?
Well, I think it's through osmosis as much as anything. He was, you know, he worked week in and week out. He was always at a sports event. It meant a lot of travel. In the summers, we would go with him. I have two brothers, and he would pack us up and take us with him as a family. And so I was running around golf tournaments. He'd get badges for us. So, and we just have the run of the golf course at, you know, major championship events. I think I went to my first US Open golf tournament when I was probably 7 or 8 years old. So I just really grew up steeped in it. And then when I became a big reader and expressed some interest in writing, you know, he had a lot of things to say about writing and the right way to do it. And he just always said, you know, learn your craft. He was the one who advised me to go to work for a newspaper because he said, you'll have to write every single day. And that's the best way to learn.
And what other lessons do you think he's left behind as part of his legacy?
Well, you know, he was a very honest writer, a funny writer, but more importantly, a very honest writer. He wrote the truth about what he saw and what he covered. He believed there was a lot of excessive sentimentality and sort of hero worship around athletes. And he wanted to cut through all that to what was really important about them, what they do that's truly great, as opposed to sort of children's literature, as he called it. He had very little patience for, you know, win one for the Gipper and you know, a lot of cliche fairy tales around sports and sports history. And so he was always very clear in his own work to make it clear these were real people doing real things. They had started out in life as ordinary folks like you and me, and they had the same flaws that you and me have. That was his biggest influence on me as a writer. I learned early on not to view athletes as superheroes, you know, but as people. My father asked a question early on that I remember him saying when I was in, I think it was in junior high school or high school, and he would say, and it was a rhetorical question, he would say, "Who can explain the athletic heart?" And he meant that it was a very mysterious organ that that great, great athletes have heart, deep heart, that's about more than just, you know, pumping blood to their muscles, that there is something more animating them and aspirational to them.
It's clear from your writing over the years that you've never shied away from controversy. Has that been a tough route for you to take?
No, not at all, because of my dad. Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, okay, so taking a tough position, like what's the worst that's going to happen to you? You'll get some hate mail or people will call you stuff on Twitter. I mean, I learned early, don't pay attention to that stuff. And, you know, what's more important is that it be a good position, you know, that it be a well-argued position. If it's not popular, the fact that it's well-argued and that you think it's grounded in some pretty good principles, if it's not popular initially, it will become more popular over time if you're right, you know, if you've found the right ground to stand on. And I can't think of a better example than Dan Snyder, the owner of the Washington Football Club, who I think I identified early on as a reckless, irresponsible owner and an unpleasant human being who did not treat people well and who was duplicitous. And I was not popular at all in Washington for many years for writing that about him as often as I could or as often as the occasion demanded. And it became clear that it was the truth. And what happens is you then become very, you know, all the more respected because you had the guts to write it early.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And then, of course, it enables you to significantly impact the outcome by bringing awareness, right?
Yeah. But I mean, I think the people who really affected the outcome were the women who were sexually harassed within the team. And then the people who were silenced or gagged, you know, by the cover up of that. So, I mean, I don't take credit there. I take credit for spotting the fact that this was not a healthy personality and not a good leader who was running the team out of what I felt was a good bit of narcissism as opposed to responsibility and not telling the truth about his actions. So at any rate, and that's just one example. I mean, most of the positions you take in sports, let's face it, you know, are not that profound. There are some instances, human rights abuses in China in the run-up to the Olympics. Same thing with, you know, I felt Vladimir Putin's regime should not have been rewarded with an Olympics or any other world sporting events because of his conduct. Those are important issues, but most of the things that people get mad about are in sports are not world-shaking events. And so, you know, the people I take shots at when I take shots at them are owners and commissioners usually. And if the worst thing that ever happens to them is Sally Jenkins raps them on the knuckles with her ruler in a sports column, then they'll be very lucky.
Let's talk about a different situation. And so 10 years ago, you got a lot of grief for writing the article, "Why I'm Not Angry at Lance Armstrong." And, you know, you'd written a couple books with him, you know, and then you wrote the column about how he apologized to you for deceiving you about his doping. Talk about that one.
Well, you know, I really like Lance. I always have. I consider him a friend. You know, I believed him, and he's apologized. He's basically told me in a meaningful way that he feels like there's a lot of people who say he was, you know, that they were his victims. And some of those people, maybe even a lot of those people, really weren't his victims. They did a lot of stuff too in the cycling world. I think that he feels what he expressed to me was his real victims were the people who really, really believed in him. And he said, "And you're one of them." And I did, you know, I believed him. I don't apologize for that. It's funny. My friend and former boss, Don Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, said a very important thing to me during that whole thing. He said, "Sally, don't ever feel badly for having believed in something." And It was a really great piece of encouragement at a moment that I needed it, and obviously felt badly and was questioning my own judgment. But Don really kind of shored me up, which I appreciated. The second thing I'll say about Lance is, you know, I never have thought, and I've written this a million times very independently of Lance. I've written it about Marion Jones. I've written it about Barry Bonds. I think that doping is an issue that we will be significantly rethinking based on science and moral judgments, just like we used to call professional athletes dirty for taking money. You know, there is so much of sports doping that, or so-called doping, that is morally really not that objectionable to me. You know, what's objectionable is when it's a human rights violation. If an authoritarian government is forcing young people to take substances against their will, that's a problem. If someone is trying to take a substance to feel better so they can go to work again the next day, they're not doing anything that a roofer or an Air Force pilot doesn't do, or every star in Hollywood. And so I feel like we've singled out athletes as, quote, dopers or dirty for doing things, taking substances that other Americans use every single day to recover from injuries or stiffness so they can be more resilient and go back to work the next day. Most of doping takes place around the issue of recovery, right? The number of instances and substances where people are taking something in order to go, you know, a second or a half a second faster than someone else in the race, those are rare. Most athletes are using these substances in order to train harder and recover faster. Interesting moral difference there, right? And I've never been convinced that we're actually defining cheating properly with those substances, you know?
What else do you see in the culture of sports that really concerns you or that you'd like to see shifted?
I mean, the biggest shift that I would like to see is I would like to see athletes have more ownership across the board in the governance of their sport. Ownership, I would like to see athletes become big enough entrepreneurs that they can buy teams and own teams. I would like to see them be, you know, for lack of a better word, stockholders. You know, the fact that our Olympic athletes, our USA Olympic athletes, have no rights, commercial or otherwise. The paperwork they have to sign to compete for their country is disgraceful. And I think that it might be worth at some point a walkout by our American athletes. I'd like to see a power shift. I would like to see the USOC run by a far more athlete-based organization than by a handful of, you know, for lack of a better word, suits sitting on a board, deliberating in secret, drawing up all kinds of legal paperwork that forces athletes to surrender most of their commercial and legal rights to their governing bodies when they're trying to represent their country, you know? The USOC wants all the commercial rights and none of the responsibility.
So what does that mean? So give us some examples.
I mean, look at women's soccer. I mean, here we have the greatest women's soccer program in history, in sport history. And yet we've had multiple instances of abusive coaches in the Women's Professional Soccer League in America, multiple instances of coaches who were abusing players, in a variety of ways, and they felt they had to put up with it because they needed the spot on the team to make a living. And so if I could see one big change, it would be the wrestling of our sports away from these boards who are failing in their governance, that are populated by people who are more interested in the prestige of the job than they are in actually protecting and rewarding our athletes.
That's really heavy stuff. And I'm going to ask you a question now that is more general than that about leadership, which is that, you know, of course, this is the topic of this podcast is Let Go and Lead. And I ask all my guests, what is the things you think leaders most need to let go of to be really great leaders?
I think leaders need to let go of the notion that they alone can turn the ship. I think it's a tempting idea to think that because you're in charge, like you, your hands are on the wheel and only your hands can really turn the ship. Leadership is actually a skill in which you organize a lot of people under you to move in concert to turn the organization one way or the other, you know, strategically, internally, morale-wise. You have to get people's agreement and buy-in, no matter how genius your decision or your strategy is. And this is what's most important about culture. You actually enact decisions through other people, like it or not. You can make the greatest call in the world, but it has to be executed by the players on the floor, for lack of a better analogy, right? Well, the same is true in an office. You know, the very same thing is true. So you have to forge a really good cohesive team, persuade them that your view of things is right and that your intentions are good and that your intentions are to prosper the entire organization and not just yourself, and then ask them to enact that. And that is real leadership. And spelling that out and really determining that in the book was one of the real pleasures of reporting it. A great leader is not this big charismatic person who just delivers orders from the top of, you know, Mount Olympus. Sometimes the best leaders are the most self-effacing person in the room.
No, that's true. And we've seen that with many people. You think of Sam Walton or other great corporate leaders that were servant leaders, really, or Gary Kelly at Southwest, or, you know.
Yeah.
Sally, it's been so wonderful talking with you today. Thanks for sharing the lessons you've learned about what sports can teach us about work and life.
My pleasure.
What a fun conversation that was with Sally. It was fascinating to discuss the parallels between great leaders in sports and the business community. Sally's access to true sports legends led her to uncover 7 principles that successful athletes and coaches have in common. Those are conditioning, practice, discipline, candor, culture, resilience, and intention. Among those 7 principles, resilience in the face of failure is the one that probably has the biggest impact for great athletes and coaches, and that also has lessons for leaders in the corporate world. Sally shared the story of Pat Summitt, the legendary women's college basketball head coach. Pat coached for 38 years and won a record 8 championships. But as Sally said, that meant she went home bitterly disappointed for 30 years of her career. If Pat was only in it for the winning, she would have been miserable. But Pat and many of the other renowned coaches like Steve Kerr are not in the business of winning, really. They're in the business of teaching and unlocking the potential in their players. I've always loved the idea of focusing on the coaching as a way to get to the big wins. So that point really resonates with me. According to Sally, discipline is one of the principles that's the hardest to master because so many people misinterpret what it means. In Sally's opinion, you can't impose discipline on other people, but rather you have to foster people's own sense of internal discipline. For business leaders, that means that you have to identify people who buy into the values inside your organization and let those people lead by example. I also really appreciated Sally's perspective about being more intentional about the decisions we make. She said that great athletes do not drift. They're highly organized and have absolute clarity around the decisions they need to make and the level of consequences that come with them. In the business world, most of us make too many decisions daily that are meaningless and have very low stakes, so the potential upside is low. Imposing more discipline and intentionality around decisions is an excellent lesson from great athletes. Finally, as I do with all my guests, I ask Sally what leaders should let go of. She said leaders need to let go of the notion that they alone can steer the ship. Her point was that great leaders, both in the sports world and the corporate world, need to enact decisions through other people. So your responsibility actually is to forge a cohesive team, persuade them that your intentions are good, and ask them to enact your decisions. In her experience, the best leaders are often the most self-effacing person in the room. I couldn't agree more. I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Sally. Remember to subscribe to Let Go and Lead on your favorite podcast platform and be the first to hear conversations and ideas from other thought-provoking leadership champions, including Amy Edmondson, Veda Manager, Mark Crawley, and Ann Powell. And thanks for joining. See you on the next episode of Let Go and Lead.